Welcome to the Deep Dive. We take a stack of information and really try to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge for you. Today, we're plunging into the fascinating and, let's be honest, often complex world of how businesses grow, survive, and sometimes how they dominate markets. Our mission for you today is to unpack the essential insights from the sources you've shared. We're looking at why firms vary so much in size, the different ways they expand, and the surprising challenges they face, both external and internal ones. As we dive in, let's maybe keep this question in mind. Is ultimate business success really a matter of brilliant strategy, or is it fundamentally about wrestling with these inherent conflicts, you know, both outside and inside the company?
That's a great question to frame this. Because yeah, we'll explore everything from those subtle factors determining a firm's scale, all the way to the dramatic mergers and acquisitions you read about. Plus, those often hidden agreements firms sometimes make to control markets. And we'll definitely touch on that key internal conflict, the principal agent problem. It can deeply affect a firm's efficiency, its decision making. By the end of this deep dive, you should have a much clearer understanding of the forces shaping the businesses all around us, and maybe, yeah, a new lens for looking at those corporate headlines.
Okay, let's unpack this then. When we look around, it's obvious, right? We see these massive corporations and then tiny local shops. Why? Why do firms vary so significantly in size? It can't just be about how ambitious the founders are, surely.
That's a perfect starting point, because you're right, it's much more nuanced than just ambition. Our sources point to a whole variety of interconnected factors. A major driver, maybe the most obvious one, is access to capital. Larger firms, generally, they just have more financial resources, better access to credit markets. That lets them make those big investments in new tech or, you know, huge expansion projects. Smaller firms, well, they often rely on the owner's savings, maybe limited bank loans. It's a different ballgame.
Right. So it's not just having the cash, but also having the management structure, the foresight, maybe, to actually use it effectively. That feels key.
Precisely. And then there's simple market demand. Some products, some services, they just serve local or niche markets. Inherently, they might only need smaller scale operations. Think about, like, your neighborhood bakery. It might not need to expand beyond one location to be really successful. But a really big one, and this is often a real aha moment, is economies of scale. This is where larger firms get these significant cost advantages because, well, their average cost per unit drops as they produce more. This is why industries like, say, steel manufacturing or car production, they tend to favor massive firms. It's almost impossible for a small player to compete purely on cost there.
So it's not just about getting bigger. It fundamentally changes their cost structure. Does that mean some industries are almost like destined to be dominated by giants because of this principle?
In many capital-intensive sectors, yes, that's often the case. Technology and production methods definitely play a role too. If you need a huge factory, expensive machinery, well, you're looking at a larger firm, aren't you? Conversely, labor-intensive industries, think handicrafts or maybe specialized consulting, they often support smaller, more, you know, nimble enterprises. And crucially, management capacity itself can be a bottleneck. As firms grow, managing everything gets incredibly complex. A firm's ability to grow can actually be limited by the managerial experience and just the sheer capacity available to handle all that complexity.
That makes perfect sense. It's easy to forget the human element. What about external forces, like regulations and things?
Absolutely. The legal and regulatory environment is huge. Government rules, licensing requirements, even tax breaks. These can actively encourage small businesses, or on the flip side, they can restrict monopolies. They directly influence average firm size. And finally, you know, some owners just choose to keep their businesses small. It's a deliberate choice. They limit growth to maintain control, maybe avoid complexity, or perhaps sidestep certain risks that come with really large-scale operations.
Okay, so we've got all these reasons firms end up different sizes. Now, how do they actually get bigger when they decide to grow? There's sort of a clear split here, isn't there?
There is, yeah. The sources really point to two primary paths, internal expansion and external growth.
Right. Let's start with what feels, I guess, most natural, growing from within.
That's internal growth, yeah. Mm. Or organic growth, as it's often called. This just refers to a firm expanding using its own resources. So no merging, no acquiring another company. It's often gradual. It includes things like increasing output of current products because demand is up, or opening new branches, you know, expanding geographically, investing in capital, better machines, better tech to boost productivity, and simply hiring more staff to handle the bigger operations. It's like carefully tending and expanding your own garden bit by bit.
And what if a firm wants to broaden its horizons, like expand its offerings or reach into totally new areas?
That's where diversification comes in. It's about expanding the range of products or markets a firm operates in. It's a really good strategy for spreading risk, you know? Our sources highlight two main types here. First, product diversification. That's introducing new products into markets you're already in. Think of, I don't know, a car company starting to make electric scooters for the same cities. And then there's market diversification. That's entering entirely new geographic markets. Could be with existing products, could be with new ones. So, like that car company deciding to start selling its cars in a completely new country, the advantages are pretty clear. Less dependence on one product or market opens up new revenue streams, spreads risk, and potentially improves long-term sustainability quite a bit.
Sounds like a smart way to, you know, weather economic storms or shifts in taste. But here's where it gets really interesting for me. What happens when firms want to grow much, much faster than their own internal resources allow? When do they just decide to, well, buy their way to growth instead of building it?
Exactly. That's external growth. It happens when a firm expands by joining with or acquiring another firm. And you're right, this is often a much faster, sometimes more aggressive way to grow compared to organic expansion. Our sources detail some distinct methods of integration. First up, there's horizontal integration. This happens between firms that are at the same stage of production in the same industry. Think of two big supermarkets merging, or two car manufacturers, like you saw with Daimler-Benz and Chrysler years ago. The main goal there, usually increase market share, reduce competition, and gain, hopefully, massive economies of scale.
Right, grabbing an even bigger piece of the same pie. Okay, and then there's vertical, isn't there? That's more about controlling the whole chain, upstream and downstream.
Exactly right. Vertical integration is when firms at different stages of production, but in the same industry, come together. You've got backward vertical integration. That's when a firm takes control of its suppliers, like a clothing brand buying a textile factory. It's about securing your inputs, making sure you get what you need. And then forward vertical integration is when a firm takes control of its distributors or retailers, like a big coffee producer opening its own chain of coffee shops. This lets them control the output, get closer to the final consumer.
I can definitely see how that gives them huge control over a whole pipeline from start to finish. But aren't there common pitfalls with vertical integration, things firms might overlook?
Oh, absolutely. While it definitely offers control, it also massively increases internal complexity. It can make a firm less agile, less flexible, especially if one part of that integrated chain starts to underperform or maybe becomes obsolete because of technology. You're kind of putting all your eggs in one very long basket, so to speak. Then there's the really interesting one, conglomerate integration. This is fascinating because it involves firms in completely unrelated industries. An example might be, I don't know, a food company merging with a tech company or a media giant buying an insurance firm. The main aims here are usually massive risk diversification. You know, if one industry tanks, the other might be booming and just entering entirely new markets wholesale.
Wow, that's quite a strategic leap. So the reasons for integration, pulling these different types together, they seem pretty varied. It's everything from efficiency to just raw market power.
They really are. Besides just achieving economies of scale, like through bulk buying or shared marketing, integration can significantly expand market power, give access to new markets or crucial technologies. It can enhance brand value, increase efficiency through synergy, that buzzword. And sometimes it's even about benefiting from the managerial expertise of the company you acquire. Think about Disney acquiring Pixar. That wasn't just about market share, it was about accessing incredible creative talent and cutting-edge animation technology.
Okay, but integrating, merging, it's not always smooth sailing, is it? There are significant consequences of integration, both good and bad, for, well, everyone involved. Feels like a pretty high-stakes gamble sometimes.
It often is, absolutely. On the positive side, yeah, it can lead to reduced unit costs, increased market share, diversification, potentially even benefiting consumers through lower prices if the market stays competitive afterward. That's a big if. But the negative consequences can be substantial too. Potential job losses due to overlap, that's a big one. Significant cultural clashes between the merging firms that can completely derail the whole integration process. Serious concerns about monopolies forming if a merger creates too dominant a player. And linked to that, a possible reduction in consumer choice and maybe even less innovation if competition dwindles too much.
So external growth, powerful, definitely, but also a risky path to market domination. Okay, but what happens when firms decide maybe not to compete so hard? when they decide to collude instead, perhaps to maintain the very market power they just fought to consolidate.
You're hitting on a really critical point there about market dynamics. And yeah, speaking of market power, sometimes firms don't just grow bigger to outcompete. Sometimes they decide to cooperate in ways that, well, really raise eyebrows. You've probably heard the term cartel in the news, right? It sounds a bit shadowy, maybe a bit illegal.
Yeah.
And usually for good reason.
Yeah, it definitely has that connotation. What exactly is a cartel in this business context?
So a cartel, as our sources explain it, is basically a formal agreement among firms. It's typically in an oligopoly where you only have a few dominant players anyway. And the agreement is to control prices or limit output or restrict competition in some other way. It's essentially collusion, right? Designed to maximize their collective profits, often, unfortunately, at the expense of consumers.
Okay, so for this kind of secret club to actually work, what conditions need to be in place? How does a cartel actually manage to stick together?
Right. For a cartel to really hold, several conditions are pretty key. First, you generally need few firms in the industry. It's just much easier to monitor and enforce agreements when there are only, say, 4 or 5 players compared to 50. Second, you absolutely need significant barriers to entry. You have to prevent new competitors from just popping up and undercutting the cartel's prices. If entry is easy, the cartel probably won't last long. Ideally, the firms should have similar cost structures. This makes it less tempting for one firm, maybe a more efficient one, to break ranks and lower prices to grab market share. High industry concentration obviously helps too. If a few firms already control most of the market, collusion is more feasible. And finally, you need a degree of transparency. Firms need to be able to sort of see what others are charging or producing. It helps maintain the agreement. It's all about trust, but also the threat of punishment if someone cheats.
Hmm. It sounds almost like this delicate house of cards, doesn't it? Like it could collapse if any one of those elements is missing or breaks down. What are the broader consequences then when these cartels do manage to form and succeed?
The consequences of cartels are pretty significant, yeah. And they affect everyone. For the firms in the cartel, well, they stand to gain increased profits, maybe reduced uncertainty. That's their motivation, obviously. But for you, the consumer, the picture is usually far less rosy. You'll typically face higher prices than you would in a competitive market, probably reduced choices. And economists talk about allocative inefficiency, basically. Resources aren't being distributed optimally in the economy because prices are artificially high. You could maybe think about how the diamond industry has historically operated, perhaps, where control over supply has significantly influenced prices and consumer options. For the market as a whole, cartels can really stifle innovation. Why bother improving if you've got a cozy arrangement? And they can lead to market failure. And crucially, this is why cartels are illegal in many, many countries and face really stringent regulatory action because of these negative impacts.
Okay, so we've seen how firms battle external forces, competition, regulations, and even each other, sometimes secretly, to gain market power. But this brings up another important question, right? Even within a successful large firm, are everyone's goals really aligned? Or can there be an internal kind of tug of war that's just as challenging as any external competitor?
That's a crucial next step, definitely. Moving from those external market dynamics to the internal organizational challenges. And what's fascinating here is even in a firm that's grown successfully, maybe diversified well, there can be this fundamental conflict that really impacts its performance. It's called the principal agent problem.
Yes, the principal agent problem. Tell us about that. Because the real aha here isn't just that managers might chase their own goals, right? It's how incredibly difficult it is to perfectly align everyone's incentives. It creates this constant tension, doesn't it? Right at the heart of corporate power. Even the best systems seem to struggle to fix it completely.
You've hit the nail on the head there. That's the core insight. The principal agent problem arises basically because of the separation between ownership and control in many firms, especially large public ones. The owners, typically the shareholders, they're the principals. And the managers, the executives who actually run the company day to day, they're the agents acting on behalf of the owners. The core issue, the problem, is that these agents, the managers, may not always act purely in the best interests of the principals, the owners. Instead, they might pursue their own goals, which can include things like increasing their own power or influence within the firm. You know, empire building. Or maybe maximizing sales or revenue because that looks good or feels good, even if it doesn't actually lead to the highest profit for shareholders. Or perhaps enjoying perks, fancy offices, large teams, rather than focusing relentlessly on efficiency and shareholder returns.
So their incentives just aren't always perfectly aligned with the people who actually own the company. It sounds like a constant balancing act.
Exactly. And the result of this potential divergence of interest is, well, a potential loss of efficiency and ultimately reduced shareholder value. Fortunately, our sources also outline some solutions to try and mitigate this problem. Though, as you said, achieving perfect alignment is probably impossible. Performance-based incentives are common. Things like stock options, bonuses tied directly to profit or share price, trying to link manager compensation to shareholder returns. Monitoring is another key part. Implementing robust internal audits, having external auditors check the books, it keeps management accountable, hopefully. Strong governance structures are crucial too, like having an active, independent board oversight where the board of directors really holds management accountable. And finally, you sometimes see shareholder activism, where large shareholders or groups of owners get directly involved in decision-making processes to make sure their interests are front and center.
So understanding this really helps you see behind this sort of corporate curtain, doesn't it? Whether you're an investor or an employee or just an informed citizen watching the business world, it really shows how complex human motivations and simple self-interest play out even inside these big successful organizations.
It really does. It highlights that even within a highly successful firm, you're still dealing with human nature, competing priorities, and potential conflicts of interest.
Wow. What a deep dive indeed. We started off exploring why firms come in, well, all shapes and sizes. Then we unpacked the two main ways they grow organically, from within and externally, through those powerful mergers and acquisitions.
And we also revealed some of the strategic and sometimes, yeah, illicit ways firms try to control markets through things like cartels.
Right.
Finally, we looked inward at that principal-agent problem, a really fundamental challenge of just aligning goals within the firm itself. It really highlights that the growth, the survival, even the dominance of firms, it's incredibly complex. It's driven by this mix of external market forces and internal strategic decisions and, yes, conflicts too.
Indeed. So given everything we discussed, how firms grow, the challenges they face, both outside and in, what do you think? What's the biggest risk for rapidly expanding companies with that external competitor nipping at their heels? Or is it maybe an internal conflict of interest, that principal-agent problem undermining things from within? Something for you to mull over. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.